So the title of this evening's talk is Intention and the Power of Thought. Thoughts and intentions are very potent and powerful forces behind our actions. They can be rooted in wholesome or unwholesome intentions. And these inspire actions that create the conditions that then characterize this life and perhaps future lives. The Buddha was a rather original thinker for his time. Whereas the early Brahmanism tended to equate ethical actions or potent actions, what would be considered right actions, with the correct performance of religious ritual, the Buddha disregarded rituals and sacrifices, and instead he highlighted the intention as what was the significant feature that determined whether something was moral or not. Philosophers and meditators in the Buddha's day were grappling with issues that circled around how they understood the causes and the effects of choices and actions, of what was wrong and what was right. One of the Buddha's contemporaries, a founder of the Jain religion, apparently taught that actions themselves created the merit or the demerit, whether or not there was an intention to cause harm or benefit. And we find discourses written, of course, from the Buddhist perspective in the Pali Canon that refer to these early beliefs. Now, this view is a bit problematic because we cause harm all the time, even without intending. It's pretty hard, no matter how much you do little hopscotch, skip, and jump to take a walk out here without stepping on some ant somewhere. For that matter, even just breathing, we could breathe in little tiny, tiny insects. We cause harm without even wanting to. So if we're always killing, and killing is unethical, then how could we ever live a good and a pure life? How can we, could we ever free the mind to realize the ultimate peace of release? Now, this issue is raised when one of the Buddha's monks, who was blind, and yet he was considered a fully enlightened being, an arahant. This monk, this blind monk, was criticized by his fellow companions because when he walked, he was killing little bugs and insects. But the Buddha explained that there was no fault on his part, that his mind was utterly pure and his realization was complete. There was no fault for him having stepped and squashed little bugs. So this act of killing didn't disturb the purity of his realization, because this act of killing was without the intention to kill. The Buddhist teachings locate the ethical force of our intentional of our actions in the intention. It's the intentional aspect of the action that makes something moral or immoral. It's the intention that makes it wholesome or unwholesome. That's what creates the merit or the demerit, not the physical action itself. And this was quite significant as a philosophy, especially at the time of the Buddha, because it was definitely in contrast to the early Brahmanic traditions, where the Brahmin priests had a kind of social responsibility to perform rituals. Their rituals were believed to, in a way, protect the fabric of society, to maintain a kind of harmonious order of the world, to maintain an integrity of relations between the various realms of existence. It was believed that without these rituals, the world system would become imbalanced. Evil might triumph over good. Storms and famines might destroy life, and general chaos might ensue. So careful and precise ritual behaviors and sacrificial practices developed. Most well known might be the maintaining of the ritual fires, or the rituals that were performed at marriages or funeral services. The marriage rituals were thought to actually have an impact on the family's future. If they were performed right, then it might increase the fertility or the prosperity of the family. And the funeral rites were thought to actually have an effect on the rebirth options of the deceased. But the Buddha countered these beliefs with a teaching that denied the power of ritual and refocused attention to the relationship between intention and the action. This was a significant contribution that contradicted some of the common ideologies and beliefs of his time. But for us, it may be less of a philosophical issue. We might be working with intention simply to see how does a thought lead to an action, because thought has an enormous impact on us, whether we're conscious of the quality of our thoughts or not. In meditation practice, we can see the basis of our thoughts. We can look and determine whether our thoughts are rooted in greed or non-greed, hate or non-hate, delusion or non-delusion. In meditation practice, we can examine how our thoughts function. How do they arise in response to sensory impacts? How do we experience our intentions? In meditation practice, we can see what they lead to, what they cultivate, what patterns and habits form out of them, what conditions they perpetuate. For instance, you might find, perhaps, a pattern of chronic complaining. And what does it cultivate? It might cultivate irritability, anger. Or you might recognize that you frequently have thoughts of the good. You might frequently see somebody and see their good side, see their virtues. And what is that condition? It might condition to trust. When we have seen how our thoughts affect our actions and traced the actions to observe what they develop into, what the fruits are, then we empower ourselves to affect the direction that our own minds incline towards. Now, there's one quote that we find often attributed to the Buddha, but there's no quote like this in the Pali Canon. So I searched online, and I found most of the time it was attributed to the Buddha. A few times it was attributed to Taoism, and it even appeared in one of those websites of quotes the Buddha never said. There actually is a website that's something like what the Buddha never said, and it's just a website of quotes that are popularly attributed to the Buddha and cannot be found anywhere in the teachings of the Buddha. But I like this quote anyway. And it isn't that he doesn't teach all these different teachings, it's just he never really said it this beautifully. But you might even find this quote familiar. From Anonymous, let's say. The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its way with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings, as the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. Sometimes people feel trapped, not by external forces, but by their own internal mental processes, their unseen habitual tendencies, and find themselves blindly acting out of craving, impulsiveness, fear, anger, or some kind of narcissistic desire. But we don't have to be controlled by the force of our habits, our fears, or our conditioning. The Buddha taught us how to use thought skillfully rather than discover that we're being used by thought. The Pali term chetana is usually translated as intention or volition, sometimes purpose, even will. Intentions are volitional thoughts that are linked to actions. They're the topic of the second factor on the Noble Eightfold Path, Sammasankappa. Wise intentions generate happiness. Unwise intentions generate suffering. Now, this second step on the Noble Eightfold Path includes two opposing sets of categories. There are wrong intentions and there are right intentions. So we have to look at both when we start to understand what this development of the path includes. Wrong intentions are the intention towards sensual desire, the intention towards ill will, and the intention towards cruelty. Whereas right intention is the intention of renunciation, sometimes described as generosity or letting go, the intention of non-ill will, which can be described as loving kindness, or the intention of non-cruelty, which might be described as compassion. Renunciation overcomes holding, grasping. It overcomes the addiction to sensual pleasures and personal comforts. Loving kindness overcomes ill will, aversion, hatred, grudges, resentment. Compassion overcomes harshness, intolerance, cruelty, and aggression. In mild or overt modes, we're all probably familiar with these modes of thought. But we don't just have one single overarching intention that lasts throughout our lives or even throughout our day. Intention is not one grand force that looms over our lives or defines who we are or even characterizes our basic nature. But rather, impulses arise moment by moment and flavor the choices that we make. Split second by split second, intentions arise and are applied in moment-to-moment experiences. You can mindfully experience the intentions that arise within your own mind. You can, at times, pay close attention to the intention that arises. Notice, how are you applying your attention to anything? How are you observing the breath? How are you listening to the talk? How do you experience the sounds that surround this building? How do you attend to thoughts about the day? Try to tune into the volitional influence right in that moment of contact. What is your attitude, your motivation, your orientation to experience? For example, are you listening with mindfulness to this Dhamma talk, motivated to try to understand in order to reduce or free yourself from suffering? Or are you listening with a fault-finding attitude, looking for an opportunity to correct me, to find something that I say that's wrong? Or are you comparing what you hear with other philosophies, other beliefs, judging and evaluating what you hear against personal views? Are you listening with a mind that's imbued with friendliness, metta, joy? There are so many ways that we can listen. In one discourse called Two Kinds of Thought, the Buddha gave us something of a blueprint, a map for how to practically work with thoughts. And he described his own experience prior to his awakening. He said, "As I abided, thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me." Well, this might happen to anybody, right? We come to the retreat, we're diligent, we're ardent, we're resolute. We come into the meditation hall with all the best intentions to meditate, but nevertheless, we sit down and a desire arises. So he says, "I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana." Now, when you noticed some desire arise, did those second thoughts arise too? Becoming mindful of that thought, and then seeing where it leads. Is it leading towards suffering, towards affliction for oneself and others? And then he repeats the exact same thing, not just for sensual desire, but then for ill will and cruelty. And then it goes on. "When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it." And then he repeats the whole thing for ill will and for cruelty, for thoughts of cruelty. So he responded very wisely here. He recognized that it leads to his own affliction, suffering, pain. And it leads to the suffering, pain, and affliction of others. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties. And so he responded. After he investigated and understood the effect of those thoughts, he responded. He abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. And then the discourse continues, and this may be one of the most interesting lines. He said, "Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind." If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thoughts of renunciation to cultivate the thoughts of sensual desire, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will or thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty to cultivate the thoughts of ill will and cruelty. And his mind inclines to thoughts of ill will and cruelty. It's actually a very powerful statement. He's saying we have a lot of control over our minds, that we are choosing at some level what we think. How conscious that choice is, how intentional that choice is, could certainly be questioned. Maybe it's a choice that's accumulated through unobserved patterns and habits. But he's saying here that we can take responsibility for our own conditioning, and we can reflect on how we participate in the conditioning of our own minds. And he used the simile of a cow herd who in the autumn, when the crops thicken, guards his cows by constantly poking them to check them and curb them. The cowherd sees that he could be punished, fined, or blamed if he allows his cows to stray into the crops. And then he says, so too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. This discourse is an interesting one, not to judge ourselves, but to ask ourselves, to what extent do we look at the effect of our own thoughts? Do we confront our minds when they're spinning out of control into unwholesome thoughts? Do we look at the habit patterns that we cultivate within our own minds? Do we train our minds? Do we poke at it and protect it the way we might work with a cow that might stray into the fields? Do we watch it carefully, guard it when there's danger nearby? What is dangerous to our minds? Usually it's something that'll stimulate craving, something that'll stimulate attachment, reaction, hatred, desire. We can find those dangers almost any time that greed or ill will arises. It could be any time. It could be, at a party or a gathering. It could be just talking with colleagues, at the office. It could be a time when we're meeting, an old friend. Does comparing arise? Does fear arise? Does judgment or ill will or envy or jealousy? We can be on guard and protect our minds with diligent mindfulness when we know that we're going to enter a situation that could easily trigger desire, conceit, envy, jealousy, anger, irritation, impatience, hatred. So we can consider for ourselves what situations we're likely to react in these ways. What situations are likely to give rise to some kind of unwholesome response within us? And then we'll know when we enter into this situation, we must be on guard to protect and prod our own minds so that they stay on track. But this discourse continues. And he says, as he abided diligent, ardent, and resolute, now a thought of renunciation, of loving kindness, and of compassion arose. He understood, this thought of renunciation, of loving kindness, of compassion has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned thoughts of sensual desire to cultivate thoughts of renunciation. If she frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of loving kindness, she has abandoned ill will to cultivate thoughts of loving kindness. If she frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of compassion, she has abandoned thoughts of cruelty to cultivate thoughts of compassion. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been harvested by the villagers, a cowherd would guard his cows simply by staying at the root of a tree. Since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there, so too there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. It's a lovely image, isn't it? When we see how our mind is wholesome. We don't have to be on guard all the time. We can really relax. We can trust it. We just are mindful of what is present. Oh, there's calmness. There's tranquility. There's peacefulness. There's renunciation, there's generosity, there's loving kindness. We can all take this responsibility and notice what the states are that are arising within our own minds. And we can ask ourselves, where are they leading? To our harm or for our benefit? Are they wholesome or unwholesome? And notice, start to notice what we indulge in, what mental patterns we are nurturing day in and day out. What thoughts do we frequently think and ponder upon? Because that will be the inclination of our minds. Do we frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of letting go, of release, of renunciation, or of kindness and friendliness and goodwill, or of compassion, of how we can help, how we can serve? And the Buddha continued, As I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. So as he was thinking about the wholesome thoughts, there was no concern there, no worry. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. This is interesting to me because the Buddha found that even though there was no problem with the wholesome states of mind, sometimes rest and quiet and peace is really beneficial. He valued the wholesome process. He valued cultivating wholesome states, but he also recognized the need to just be quiet, to relax, to find a respite from the basic agitation that's inherent in thinking. In formal meditation practice, the force of intention is very potent. We learned to direct our intention, and this is a very powerful meditative skill that we develop. This is heightened as we develop concentration, because in the development of concentration, and most profoundly in the deep states of absorptive meditation called jhana, the power of intention is what guides the development of the mind. Progress through the concentration states of absorption of jhana occurs by skillfully inclining the mind toward our object of meditation or towards the desired state. Gross effort is not required. In fact, gross effort would agitate the mind and disrupt the concentration. And yet, we still need the intention guides that development. Mastery of the jhana requires that the mind responds precisely to our intentions. In fact, we learn to enter and exit meditative states, concentrated states, based upon time durations. We learn to enter a concentrated state for 12 minutes, or for 25 minutes, or for 53 minutes, or for 110 minutes, however many minutes we choose. And we check to see that our minds come out of that state on time. It's quite interesting to see when we establish an intention and the mind is calm and quiet and the samadhi is well established, that we actually do respond to those intentions. But also, after insight practice, and after insight practice has matured to some degree of awakening, in the Theravada tradition, there are four stages of awakening. These are moments when the mind is profoundly affected and purified by a deep, deep, deep realization. And there are four distinct stages The first being called the stream enterer or the sotapanna, when one has entered the stream. Once one has experienced one of these states, in this moment, nibbana is realized, then how do we re-experience it? Now, we don't re-experience it by craving to have the experience again and again, because craving is not going to help very much. And yet there's something very healthy, very wholesome about the mind resting in this deep, deep state of peace with nibbana, with release as the object. There are many descriptions in the discourses of monks who abided in voidness, who could return again and again at will to this experience of, I don't know how to say it other than profound peace, a profound state of peace that could be sustained for long periods of time. How does one do that? It's through the power of intention. One takes that fruition attainment as the object and intends and directs the mind to it through intention. It's subtle, because at this point you can't go slogging around with coarse effort. And yet there's still a directing of our energies and of our minds through this power of intention. Now, most of us, though, are not abiding in jhana or fruition most of the time, right? That's fair to say. And so we have to work with intention in our ordinary everyday lives. Our attitude to any situation that we're in is going to reveal our intentions. You might just reflect at the beginning of any action, what is your motivation? Whose interest is the action serving? Where is the action leading? What are the consequences likely to be? Basically, we're asking, does it lead to my affliction, another's affliction, or the affliction of both? And I think we have to be really honest with ourselves about whether the intentions that are arising in our own minds are wholesome or unwholesome. Because if we value the possibility of liberation, then there's no point in pretending we're more virtuous than we are. We have to face ourselves squarely and see the negative when that exists, just as much as the beautiful when that exists. We can recognize the agitation and the conceit that are sometimes intertwined with wholesome states of kindness and compassion and generosity. Sometimes pride asserts itself right in the midst of an otherwise virtuous act. Arrogance mixes in with an act of generosity, or fear arises in the midst of compassionate service. This is all normal. We have to trust ourselves to be present with our experience from the intention right through the action, and to allow a purity of our intentions to develop while we're engaged in the actions. No one likes to think of themselves as cruel or greedy or selfish or arrogant or dominated by ill will. But often these are just subtle forces in our mind stream, an underlying tendency, and it might be present any time there's anxiety or envy, resentment, pity, the disparaging of others, or blame. It isn't sociopathic. It isn't even evil. It might even be considered socially normal. But the Dhamma shows us a way to respond to these underlying tendencies so that we uproot them. Because though it might be normal to have these tendencies of anxiety and fear and agitation and blame, it's not liberating. To realize complete liberation, the ending of greed, the ending of hate, the ending of delusion, we have to really look at what our minds are doing all the time. The path of Dhamma, though, is not about being a perfect person or even being a good person. The Dhamma path develops a profound experience of sublime happiness, ease, and peace. Ajahn Buddhadasa, a Thai forest monk, said, "We don't have to do anything very much to make ourselves happy. We don't have to go to any great trouble. All we have to do is empty the mind of greed, aversion, and delusion. In other words, to make it empty of grasping at and clinging to I and mine. When the mind is empty of greed, aversion, and delusion, then it's truly empty, and all dukkha, suffering, comes to an end. Even kama will of itself come to an end." This describes the potential that we all have to uproot greed, hatred, and delusion. However, people sometimes have unexamined or selfish reasons for doing the things that we like to do. In a mindfulness-based liberation practice, we must be willing to examine our inner intentions regarding all our actions, mental, verbal, and physical actions. And we can start with very simple and ordinary things. When you come into the hall to meditate and you sit down, what do you intend for that sitting? When you wake up in the morning and you get out of bed, do you take a moment to establish your intention for the day? When you enter into a social environment, maybe the food line here, or at home it might be a group or a family dinner or a meeting, do you take a moment to establish the intention of loving kindness towards all the beings you encounter? When an action begins, did you notice the intention to act? You know, you never move without some intention towards that movement. Do you notice when there's an itch that there's an intention to scratch? Do you notice that you don't just open your eyes because the bell rang? That there's actually an intention to open your eyes. There's an intention to stand up. There's an intention to put on your shoes. There's an intention to lift the heel in the walking meditation. There's an intention to move the foot forward. There's an intention to lower it down. There actually isn't an intention to touch. At some point in the lowering, you touch. Do you ever notice those intentions? To notice the interaction of the intention and the action, to use intention as a bridge to observe how mind and body interact and function, even in a simple act such as walking. What about when you get your plate of food? Now, you don't just, scoop it into your mouth. There's an intention. There's an intention to lift up the fork, to reach, to go more towards the tomato or more towards the cucumber or more towards the cabbage. What is that based on? Do you take the ones you don't like first so that you have the better ones, the ones you like for dessert afterwards? Do you save your cabbage for dessert because you like that the best? Who likes cabbage the best? It's probably cucumbers you save for the end, right? How do you do it? What's the intention there? What's the intention? You can watch the about to move impulse in the mind. This is very important before speaking. What is the about to speak impulse? What's the intention before we speak? Now, you're not doing much speaking in this retreat, but it might be an intention before writing a note. What is the intention? What are we communicating? And what happens, say you're working with the stillness of the sitting meditation, what happens when you are observing that intention and you decide, there's an intention to scratch? Just see it as a thought, an impulse that arises and passes away, that doesn't need to actually move the arm to scratch. I would encourage you to try this tomorrow, to take 10 minutes where you make the vow to not move. And any time there's an intention to move, maybe a little squirm, maybe a little scratch, maybe a little adjustment, maybe a little this or a little that, just observe the intention. But you can either do it for 10 minutes or you could say that you're going to observe each intention 3 times and not move until the 4th. That way you can let yourself go ahead and scratch eventually if the itch persists. But you will have learned a lot about intention. You'll have recognized the intention and you'll have distinguished between the intention and the action. That is a powerful thing that will give you a lot of choice as to what intentions you then act on, because you'll know if you can catch them, if you can recognize them as a thought in the mind, you don't necessarily have to act on them. This is very helpful if you want to change a habit, if you want to give up some kind of an addictive routine, smoking, snacking, drinking, whatever it might be, some gidget and gadget that you might have in your, you know, some tempting little an electronic device, that if you want to change a routine, if you want to change a habit, if you can catch the intention to reach for it, if you can catch the craving for it, the desire for it, then you have a lot more power to unravel that action, that habitual action. And so we take the time in our meditation practice to stop, to pause, to take some time where we're not acting and not speaking so that we can see those impulses of the mind just arise and pass without needing to be completed through the action or the speech. I think it's very, very healthy for the mind to be able to refrain, to have an impulse and to refrain from doing it. To want to scratch, but to have a choice about whether we scratch or not. To stop ourselves. Because it might be a very simple thing to just say, I'm not, okay, there's a fly walking across my arm, and I'm going to just feel it. Little step, little step, little step, little step. Have you ever just watched the fly walk across your arm? Please do, if a little fly blesses you with a visit. Please just watch. They have the tiniest little feet. You can feel them. You can feel each little step of that fly. And usually we just swipe it away. You know, it can be excruciatingly painful, actually, even though it's just this tiny, little tiny step, and it won't hurt us at all. So we can observe those impulses in the mind and learn that we have a lot of choice as to what we actually do. This can be very helpful. I have a number of students who have worked with this a lot because they used to say things that they would really regret afterwards. You know, some little nasty remark. Good-hearted people, but bad speech patterns. And they would say things and then just, hate themselves for saying it. And almost they learned to feel that impulse that they were about to say something that was harsh or nasty. Usually it was in the form of a joke that the person never really thought was funny. And they were able to catch that movement through just observing that inner impulse. Can we catch ourselves when we're about to make a nasty remark and just notice it as a habitual movement within our own minds? I find it very interesting to observe what happens in my mind when I'm doing a very routine action, like driving down the freeway. It's a normal thing for me to spend an hour a day driving on a freeway. Big, long freeways with, you know, not a lot going on. You know, everybody stays in their lanes. California people drive pretty well. Getting a little faster these days, but it's not like you're city driving where you're all like looking everywhere trying to figure out what's going on and all the crazy things that somebody else is going to do. Here we get on the freeway and we kind of go along. So It's a time when it's really easy for the mind to wander. I'm not sure what your activity would be when your mind wanders. Does your mind wander in your when you're showering, when you're washing the dishes, when you're walking around the block? What is the activity in your daily routine where your mind habitually wanders, where you're just not present for it? If you can examine your own minds during these periods, you'll learn a lot. Because it's an opportunity to understand when and how and why your own mind wanders, when it disconnects from your own life. Are you entertaining yourself? Are you pleasuring yourself through the thoughts? Are you just passing the time because you're afraid to be bored or trying to be super productive so you're going to figure out more things while you're driving and multitasking? Are you reinforcing a self-image with the kind of thoughts that you think? Are the planning fantasies of the wandering mind related to conceit or to comparing? Or do they confirm a sense of self? What are those patterns? Are they desire-oriented, fear-oriented, oriented towards the past or towards the future? We can examine them and observe what we get out of it. There's some gratification, or we wouldn't be doing it again and again. We're getting something out of it. What is that? And there is a danger in it, a disadvantage. What's the price that we're paying for it? If we want to live with love and with wisdom, we can't neglect self-examination. Our experience will be influenced by whatever intentions we bring to whatever our actions are. Our meditation practice will be affected by the intentions that we have for it. Because, as the Buddha said, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. And so, consider, what do you frequently think and ponder upon? And why do you meditate? Are you meditating in order to solve a particular problem? Some people get prescriptions from their doctors to meditate. Oh, high blood pressure. Learn meditation. Control panic attacks. Learn meditation. Chronic headaches. Learn meditation. Fair enough. I actually think it's very important to try to use meditation to support some of these, or to heal, or to work with some of these difficulties. But honestly, everybody that I know who's come to meditation because a doctor has prescribed it hasn't stayed meditating, hasn't continued meditating because of their physical condition. They've continued meditating because they've learned something about their own minds, about their own lives, something far more intimate that was never a part of that prescription. So why do you meditate? Are you approaching it as a kind of self-therapy? These days, some people try to meditate in order to improve their productivity as a student or in a company. Some people meditate because they like other people who meditate, and so it's a social encounter. Some people meditate because they sense it's actually possible to do something as simple as looking at our own minds, and through that reduce the greed, hate, and delusion that plagues our world. We can cultivate the intention, the wise intentions, the intention towards renunciation, the intentions towards loving kindness and compassion as motivations for our practice, so that we really practice with these intentions. We can aspire before we do an action, whatever it might be, before we make our bed, before we dust off our cushion, before we put on our shoes, before we take a shower, before we meditate. May this action be a contributing cause for inner and outer peace, so that everything that we do begins to contribute to our experience of peace. We might dedicate our meditation with the intention, may this meditation be for the realization of awakening, or for the benefit of all beings. Right intention is a pure form of thought that's essential for the cultivation of this path of release. But remember that right intention is integrated with all the other path factors. It's integrated with right understanding and right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And it manifests as right action, right speech, and right livelihood. So when we consider right intention, we have to consider the entire eightfold path. We can't just take one fold of the path out. It's integrated in the whole experience of the path. When your intentions are clear, you'll have a deep confidence in your own trustworthiness. Not a shallow self-confidence that relies upon sort of polished performances. It's not the arrogance that comes from learning certain communication skills. It's a deep and enduring confidence that knows, without any question, that your intentions are good, that you can trust your own mind, and that those intentions will help you, help guide your actions. It may be that your actions are not always perfect. It may be that things don't turn out the way that you want, but you can still trust yourself. You can trust your intention. So you can trust the actions that come out of that intention. You can stand strong on your own two feet in conversation and in action, in solitude and in silence, so that the mind is free from worry and remorse and fear and regret. There'll be a clarity and a presence in everything that you do. And you'll observe, how did it come out? If it didn't work out so well, You'll know your intention was good, so maybe there was just some skills. You could have done it more skillfully. You could have learned something. So you'll learn something, and the next time it'll be different. From the motivation that nurtures your meditation practice to what draws you into interactions and conversations or work, I encourage you to notice your intentions. What are you cultivating? What is your intentions? And let your intentions spring from love. Let's have a few quiet moments, please.